1-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents Progress Toward Global Food Security, UN Development Goals for the Millennium by Catherine Bertini, United Nations Undersecretary General for Management, on Thursday, February 3rd at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning, Jason Croft. Let me just mention very quickly what we'll be doing tomorrow on our show. In the first hour, we'll talk with Stephen Wise. He is the author of a new book that we'll discuss. The title is Though the Heavens May Fall, and this is the book that takes a look at a trial that took place in London in 1772 that led to the abolition of the slave trade. That's the first hour. Hour two, we'll talk a little bit about tsunamis and earthquakes and look at what they are and what happens, some of the tools that we have to try to predict whether or not they will happen. Our guest will be Brian Atwater. He is a geologist with the USGS, the Geological Survey. He's also a professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington, and he'll be joining us by phone. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Well, in this Product Focus 580, we're planning on talking with Sister Helen Prejean, very well known in this country as an opponent of capital punishment. She may, in fact, be the best-known opponent of capital punishment in the United States. Right at the moment, she's traveling around the country talking about a new book that she has authored that looks at the possibility that we may have been executing people who are not guilty. Unfortunately, we couldn't link up with her this morning. If we can, we will try to get this program rescheduled and do it on another day. In the meantime, we reach into the Focus 580 archives for a conversation about something different, stem cell research. This is a past Focus program, so again, do remember, as you listen, we will not take calls in this hour. In the first hour today, we'll be exploring the science of stem cell research with science journalist Ann Parson. There are many scientists who believe stem cells could be very, very useful for regenerative medicine and could make possible cures for a wide range of diseases, including Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, diabetes, heart disease, others. We'll try on this hour of the show to review the basics, talk a little bit about what stem cells are and where they come from, and also consider some of the ethical issues that have arisen with the science. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Ann Parson has written about a number of medical topics. She is the co-author of a book, Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. She also has written articles for the Boston Globe, the New York Times, McCall's, San Diego Union Tribune, and the Harvard Health Letter. From 1990 until 1998, she taught in Boston University's graduate program in science journalism, and she's the author of a recently published book that's titled The Proteus Effect, Stem Cells and Their Promise for Medicine. It's published by the Joseph Henry Press and is out now if you want to look for it in the bookstore. Ms. Parson, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, nice to be on your show.
And we certainly appreciate it. I think that even though there's been a fair amount of coverage of the subject of stem cell research and some of the issues raised, I expect that probably there will be some people who still are not really sure what it is that we are talking about. So I think it'd probably be a good idea to go right to the most basic questions first and talk a little bit about that and then go on from there. So perhaps the most basic question that one can ask is, what is a stem cell?
Well, a stem cell is an immature cell that possesses the potential to become a specific type of mature cell. So in other words, you think of all life as having two types of cells, an immature cell, which is a stem cell, or a more mature cell. And the great thing about a stem cell is that it can keep dividing over and over and over again, whereas a mature cell kind of gets runs out of speed, so to speak, and doesn't keep dividing. So the whole notion, the whole idea here is to use that immature stem cell to make mature cells that can help replace the diseased cells in the body.
There are different kinds of stem cells, and this maybe here it would be useful to talk a little bit about what happens from the point where we have conception, the point where you get the sperm and the egg together,
right?
And then from that point, as you start to get cell division and start to have greater numbers of cells.
Right. At day five in the human embryo, the embryo is this round ball, has approximately just a couple of hundred cells, and in the middle of that ball, just about day five, there's something called the inner cell mass, which has a group of stem cells in it. Now, that's a very transient population of stem cells. That little embryo hasn't reached the uterus. It hasn't attached to the uterine wall. And once it does on, say, day seven or eight, those stem cells start differentiating, i.e. they start specializing. So in terms of different populations of stem cells, the first one to think about and the one that is so controversial because it means getting it out of the little embryo is the one in the embryo. And it's specifically, it's a 5 or 6 day old embryo. Then you have another version of stem cell, which is actually in you, in all of your organs. Most of your organs, you have something called the adult stem cell. And that's a little bit more differentiated, i.e. specialized, but it still has this capacity to multiply ad infinitum. Have I lost you yet?
No, I got you. And I think here that what to me is an important point for people to understand, because the terminology can be a little confusing. We talk about adult stem cells.
Right.
Yes, indeed. And in adult human beings, you have adult stem cells, but those actually appear long, long time before you have a fetus, you have adult stem cells. So what we're talking about is a kind of a change in the potential of the cells that occurs very early in the development.
Actually, I love it. I've forgotten who said it, but somebody said there's a lot of biology between the immature cell and the mature cell.
Mm.
There are many different stages as cells differentiate outward down a certain lineage. But yes, you have this primary stem cell in the embryo, and it does start losing some of its, versatility. The older the embryo gets, the more an embryonic stem cell goes in the direction of becoming an adult stem cell. It's losing some of its potential. So the stem cells you have in the adult body, for instance, you have skin stem cells, and you have blood stem cells, and those really are within a lineage, and so they're more specialized.
So the difference would be is when you have when you're at the embryonic stage, you could have a stem cell, say, that could either be that could become anything. But once you go just a few steps down the road there, then you have stem cells that take on specific kind of functions.
Exactly, according to the organ or system that they live in. And for instance, the skin stem cell is under the skin and constantly regenerating the skin. Again, these are adult stem cells, and there's one in the gut that constantly turns. Our gut is turning over all the time, constantly is replenishing those gut cells. There are a few organs they haven't found adult stem cells in yet, but they think there might be one progenitor cells. Now, this is to throw another term in here, not to confuse you, but I think of those as sort of in between stem and adult cells. Those are cells that have stemness, as they put it. And I probably shouldn't even bring that up.
Well, here, and I guess then now, if people have this basic idea that we do in the course of human development, there are cells that can initially, if you get them early enough, there are cells that could be anything, and then a little bit further down the line, you get cells that do still have this regenerative capability, but there are specific things that they're intended to do. The idea is that if we could harness that capability, either of those initial cells to be anything, or of the adult stem cells, again, to rebuild certain kinds of tissues, then there's the therapeutic applications are, at least in theory, are obvious, that if you have damaged organ, damaged tissue, something that's not functioning the way that it should be, the idea is that if you could take these cells and somehow introduce them into the body, that they could then rebuild or replace that thing that's damaged.
Yes. I mean, it's terrifically, I really feel we're at a turning point with this because it's a sort of a whole new standard for medicine that would be using the cells of our body to cure or treat ourselves. And, you know, it's finally that the biology of the cell is being understood well enough that we can go in this direction. So it's tremendously exciting and promising. It's not witchcraft. It's real. We already have some stem cell treatments that are actually out there and have proven themselves.
Well, I guess are we really talking about something that is still at the level of theory? That is, we have an idea of what we would hope to be able to do, but we're not really sure how exactly we would achieve that technically. Or scientists who are doing this research have a pretty good idea about how exactly they would do it.
Well, it's just so too early to generalize. Mm-hmm. You know, all these different pursuits for different diseases that are at various stages. As I say, there is the fact that we're using stem cells in the blood for bone marrow transplantations, which have been working now for 40 years. So that is a stem cell therapy. That is showing that you can use those stem cells that live in the blood, in the bone marrow, that make the blood cells and all the cells for the blood and immune system. That's, you know, that's the proof. That's one proof that treatment works. There are other novel treatments for many, many different diseases which are far from completion. I mean, they're just really at the beginning stages.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Ann Parson. She's a science journalist and has written a lot about various subjects in medicine and technology and in the environment. And her most recent book is titled The Proteus Effect, which looks at stem cells and their promise for medicine. That's the subtitle. Joseph Henry Press is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think you point out in the book that certainly scientists and naturalists had observed that within nature, there are creatures that have amazing capacity to regenerate. You know, you go out and get a starfish and you cut off one of the arms, it'll grow back.
Right.
Unfortunately, human beings don't work that way. But at what point did scientists really begin to understand this idea of regeneration, how it could happen, and then come to this understanding that in human beings, there are cells that actually have the capacity to do that?
Well, it's been so recent. Just to go back to something you said about the animals that regenerate, I talk in the book about this little hydra, which is a little sea creature, one-third of an inch long, and the reason that you can cut it in many different times and it still grows, all of it grows back, is because it's really chock full of stem cells. And it took, taken a long time right up through the 80s, 90s, to realize how important the availability of stem cells in an organ is to regeneration. That's really been a recent occurrence. And even though stem cells, for instance, were taken out of mice embryos back in early 1980s, they were really only first isolated and kept going in a dish, and that's a very important part of maintaining them. Being able to keep them living and dividing in a dish. That only happened for the human embryo in 1998. So we're really, really at the beginning here of understanding how to regenerate the body and how to go in this direction, which many people call regeneration medicine.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we do that? And we'll start with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I've got 2 points, questions. One is with stem cells in bone marrow. I've listed myself as a bone marrow donor, potential donor, and my recollection of the information to potential donors about this is that they had to type you and then match you in a multi-step process. So the adult bone marrow stem cells, if I'm understanding this correctly, are not essentially universal donors. Is there a difference in that between adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I kind of do, and I hope I answered this correctly for you, but my understanding is that the adult bone marrow stem cell, not to confuse the issue, but there are, well, the one that's used for reconstituting the blood and immune systems, it's a hard match, and I think it's something like well over the majority of people cannot find a match in their family, which is usually the source of a match. It's matching tissue to tissue, so that if you have bone marrow stem cells put back into you from someone else, they have to match your genetic profile. Now, there is the hope that younger stem cells, i.e. those from the embryo or those from cord blood, umbilical cord blood, which is taken from the umbilical cord of the baby, those being less mature stem cells are able to make for a better match more easily. Is that sort of answering what you're asking?
Well, that was what my sense was. I hadn't really thought about it. But I've been on the donor list, registry list, I don't know, 10, 15 years now, but they've never matched me up with anybody as somebody needing a donor from me. Then my second point that I'd like to make is, and something I hadn't really realized until a conversation with my daughter when she was pregnant. We were talking about miscarriages, and she was saying that she learned from her OBGYN that many more women miscarry really early and now are realizing it than used to realize it because we have better pregnancy tests than we did say when I was had children. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. Let me go see if I can find out what the percentage was. So I went to websites and I looked at on the internet, and I just typed in miscarriage, and I also looked at a couple of books at the library, and the percentage of fertilized eggs, they figure, that don't implant and don't go on to full-term birth. So we're not talking about abortion here. We're talking about natural processes.
Yeah.
60%.
Isn't it amazing?
60%.
Oh, I know. And I mean, that's one reason for using leftover in vitro fertilization embryos. I've heard that up to 75% of the little embryo that's in the fallopian tube, up to 75% never get down to the uterus to attach. So all of those are lost.
Well, to me it says that if you want to consider that this is a person and of equal value with somebody who's already here, then why does 60% and up not ever make it naturally?
Right.
It says to me that a fertilized egg is not, nature doesn't, we can call it nature, you can call it God, does not consider this to be the same as a living person and doesn't, I mean, I think we should be careful. But it helped give me some perspective about the relative value that nature puts on these.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned this. This is a key thing I'm into also. It just, I think, shows you that sometimes we're maybe humans are being a little bit too moral, overly moral, about something that nature has no morals about. Do you understand?
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying to protect that little five-day-old embryo. And perhaps say we can't use it, but then nature is getting rid of it all the time inside the woman.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right, I'll go on to another caller here with a different point of view, I'm sure. Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Could I ask you to clear up some of the confusion about stem cell research? First, isn't it true there is no ban on embryonic stem cell research? The federal, as a matter of fact, Very little embryonic stem cell research is going on, and the federal government is financing that which is going on in a limited number of lines of embryonic stem cells, but they have not banned a private embryonic...
That's absolutely correct, and I think Senator Kerry just finally caught on. I think he was using the word ban, and many other people have. No, it's not banned. What has happened is that there's a restriction on the number of human embryonic stem cell lines that researchers can use. There's not a restriction, however, on the amount of money coming from the federal government, and more money is being given by the government for use of only those couple of lines.
Well, now, even though there isn't, private researchers are completely free to study embryonic stem cells. It isn't the government's lack of financing that keeps this embryonic stem cell from research from occurring. It is the fact that embryonic stem cells are not very promising. When embryonic, literally all of the medical benefits of stem cell research have been achieved by adult stem cells, because adult stem cells are much more easily controlled to form the desired tissue. In other words, if you put an adult stem cell on nervous tissue, that adult stem cell becomes nervous tissue. If you put it on bone tissue, it becomes bone tissue. Well, on the other hand, if you use embryonic stem cells, you don't know what they're going to become. They usually go out of control. They usually, well, virtually always produce malignant tissue within a few generations.
But, you know, it's so early. As I pointed out, we only got this stem cell from the embryo in 1998. And there's so much to understand, and we shouldn't be in a rush. We need to really investigate this. It seems from, at least from all my conversations, and I've had, you know, quite a few with scientists, that it seems that they really feel it has more potential than the adult. But they, too, they just want to do their work on both versions of stem cells to find out which one will work and which is the most available.
Surely, but there isn't any ban on it. They're free to do it.
And they are doing it more and more in private situations.
Okay.
But, you know, there are a ton of academic laboratories that are beholden to Bush's restrictions. And as one postdoc said to me recently, he said, the problem is it's like being given $1 million to build a house, but only having very few 2x4s. In other words, because of the restriction of numbers of cell lines, the scientists just really don't have enough cells to work with, embryonic stem cells, that is. They have plenty of money from the government if they want it. They just don't have fresh, good stem cell lines.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. For people who don't have a lot of background on the subject, we've leapt right into the middle of the controversy, essentially.
Yeah.
Basically, the issue is this: for some people, they believe that at the moment of conception, where you get the egg and sperm together, you have a person. So then, the embryo they considered to be a person, and they don't believe that embryos should be killed. That's the word that they would use, should be sacrificed, should be destroyed to get the embryonic stem cells. And that's what you have to do. People who have that belief certainly believe that embryos should not be produced specifically as a source of stem cells. And they would go further. They would say any embryos that are even in the world now that were produced for couples who were having problems conceiving to be used in vitro fertilization, they wouldn't and are now frozen. They wouldn't even want to go as far as to say use those. And to support their argument, they go further and they say, well, you know, we do have adult stem cells, and why even bother with embryonic stem cells and all of the ethical issues that attach to them if we can use the adult stem cells? Then you just simply don't have that problem. And as people may understand, what the president did in looking at this controversy, he said, well, as far as federal funding goes, that he would go ahead and say federal funding could still be applied to existing stem cell lines, but not to creating new ones, which then gets us to the point where the point that the caller rightly makes is that there's nothing to prevent private industry or private funders from funding any kind of research they want. They don't have to use the existing lines. They could do any kind of research they want. That kind of ban only affects any researchers that are going to be using federal money.
Right.
Now, let me ask you one further question, and I'll shut up and give you a chance to talk. The question of the adequacy of the existing stem cell lines. Some people have said, look, we have these existing stem cell lines, and they're good, and they're perfectly adequate for doing this research. And others have said, well, There may be some problems with those lines, and there may be some question of exactly how many different ones there are, and so forth. And just how significant a restriction is it, do you think, to say, at least as far as the kind of research that will be funded by the federal government, to say you're limited to dealing with existing stem cell lines?
Right. That's, you know, it's good to try and take this apart like this, in that there are at the moment said to be 22 viable lines, but again, I'm talking to stem cell scientists, and many of them feel, some of them, because they were made, we're talking about the first made stem cell lines. They were made before Bush's statement in August of 2001. So they're older, and many feel there could be duds among them. The other problem is that to grow these early stem cell lines, you use another type of cell called a feeder cell. It's like a sort of a nursemaid cell, and the feeder cells that these stem cells were mixed up with are from rodents, and the feeling is that they possibly could be carrying viruses. So all those lines that are usable, unfortunately, you know, perhaps will can never be used in the clinical setting. And the other thing is, there is the chance that the older the stem cell line, the more the genes inside those cells might pick up mutations, you know. And so, and finally, there's the last point that those 22 lines are like from 22 different people, and they only have 22 different genetic profiles that they represent. And part of the beauty of stem cell research in the future will be to try and examine cells from all different genetic profiles to understand how those stem cells are contributing to diseases. And that can't really be done with such a narrow window of genetic profiles.
Well, I have several callers, and I promise I'm going to get to these people. I will not make them wait forever. Let me just, though, ask one further question.
Uh-huh.
If things continue like this, and for any people who are going to be doing their work with federal money, they're going to have to live with those restrictions, that is, only working on existing lines, or at least, you know, they can do work with adult stem cells. So the issue is the embryonic. That then, for anybody who is, for private industry, for researchers that are being funded by private sources, they're free to do whatever research they like. What are the implications, you think, that the private sector, for them, there are no limits on the kind of research that they can do?
Right.
And does, I guess I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, their motive ultimately is making money.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what a lot of people in the academic, i.e. public sector, are nervous about. Scientists in the public sector are nervous that not enough of this stem cell research that's happening in the private sector is going to be known and put forth for public inspection. The companies that are doing it they aren't like academic researchers. They don't have to write reports and papers all the time, which is kind of part of the public, you know, what goes on in the public research field. So it's hidden from view much more. And there's so much going on with this biology. I think the more that everybody, non-scientists especially, can understand, the better for the future of medicine.
We have, as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Ann Parsons. She's a science writer. She's covered a number of different topics in science and medicine. She's the co-author of a book about Alzheimer's disease, which is titled Decoding Darkness, The Search for Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. That was published in 2000. She is also the co-author of a book about menopause, and that's the title, Menopause. She's written for various publications, Boston Globe, New York Times, the Harvard Health Letter. She's taught at Boston University's graduate program in science journalism, and is the author of a book that looks at stem cells and their promise for medicine. That's the subtitle. Her book is titled The Proteus Effect, and it is published by the Joseph Henry Press. It's out now if you want to read it. Up next is a caller in Charleston, and that would be line one. Hello?
Yes, I caught on to your metaphor and building. As an amateur carpenter, I know if you don't use enough 2-inch material your building falls down. And that is very potent, I think. My two-part question, the work that is going on and its relationship to the capitalism which we live under, and then up the road, you know, George Bush can't last forever, or people such as himself, or the extreme right wing that battles, you know, the... I love the comment by, I think, one of the ladies from Now who said that of Ronald Reagan, he believed in life before birth, but not after, and which is apropos. And if the science then can get the head of the prejudice, and we still have the capitalist hoops to go through, and since there are 44 million people who have no health care insurance and limited availability, the rewards of stem cell research and its benefits then, in my view, will just be given out to those who can come up with the money.
Right.
And that flies in the face of science. You know, the science and technology is just something that is a great thing in modern times, but we need to think of its use and its benefits applied to all of humanity. And I'll ring off and listen on the radio. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. That's such an important point. And in so much is happening, as I mentioned, with biology getting deeper and deeper into the cell, into its genes, and having all this marvelous ideas of where we might go with medicine. And at the same time, you know, in other parts of the world, having just terrible poverty and still terrible, you know, disease, you know, I totally agree. I think we have to push forward into a new field, into a new realm, however, because it's beckoning to us. And it's also, I really feel the stem cell medicine is frankly a more commonsensical and natural way about medicine than the pharmaceutical we've been pursuing. Think of all that money that's wasted in the pipeline. So often that money doesn't pan out. Just thousands, billions, millions, billions wasted. So I just think we have to keep going down this road and see what we find and hope that this gets somewhere and that it will help everybody in the world.
All right, let's go to Champaign County for the next caller. Line two. Hello.
Hi. You already asked my question, I guess, in a way, because I was going to ask you to explore, and I've actually heard on McNeil Air, a proponent of stem cell research recently, make the argument that, you know, we shouldn't have this kind of research going on without the kind of public viewing and insight and peer reviewing, et cetera, that's possible. So that point's been thoroughly made now, but I think it hasn't been made enough. And I just can't figure out why a Christian fundamentalist would say, It's okay if the corporations do it for money, but if and I don't want any of my money doing it. I mean, if it's morally repugnant for it to be done in a certain way, wouldn't they want to have it, you know, a subject to review?
Yeah.
And another point is there's another courageous woman going around with a story, and she was interviewed while our host was on vacation. It was quite a good one. She's an ex-chair or editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and she points out that corporations are very used to subverting publicly funded research. They, in the middle of the Reagan era, there was some bill that allowed socially paid for research to be privatized, basically, and they're used to that, and maybe that's why they would hold back and not do the research. So they are doing some, but you know they're very used to being at the public trough and letting the government, as the expression goes, socializing the cost and privatizing the profit. And that's a bit of a digression. And I but since you asked my question, I thought I would go ahead and mention that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, do you want to go any further with that?
Well, no, he just, it's such an important point about all this being visible to everybody, And partially because science is so wonderful and biology these days is so wonderful and interesting and can take us away from so many uglies in the world, and that it does need to be out there where everybody can appreciate it.
All right, to Chicago next, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. So there was 2 points that I wanted to make with regard to the stem cell situation. One is that, in terms of talking about the adult stem cells that were discussed earlier, there have been significant successes with the adult stem cells in terms of actual experimental treatments on human beings that have shown great promise, whereas with the embryonic stem cells that there's been virtually no successes at all, or in most cases not even any attempts in terms of doing anything with human beings because of the fact that there's so much danger, as was mentioned by an earlier caller, regarding the fact of actually tumorous growths being generated from the use of stem cells, which is what's been happening with the animal experiments that have been done. So in that sense, the concept of federal money being used for adult stem cells seems to be where the more promise is, at least at this time, and that therefore it would be, from a taxpayer's point of view, logical to say that it would be more desirable to have the funds used in a more productive manner by going after something that seems to have significant success. The other aspect, which has not been mentioned, is if assuming that we did discover that the embryonic stem cells were something that was capable of resolving these problems that currently are being faced, that the fact of the tissue rejection issue, which was mentioned earlier, suggests that it basically leads us into human cloning, because the only way that you can manage to get compatible tissue for doing this is basically to clone an embryo from the human that you want to treat to get the compatible tissue and then to extract the stem cells. And to do that, you have to get a source of human eggs from which you can do the cloning process. And effectively, the big challenge that is being totally ignored is the fact that where would all these human eggs come from that would be needed to generate these starting point treatments so that you could manage to generate these clones and actually do the treatments. And effectively, it would be millions and millions of eggs needed, and you'd have to basically go through aggressive medical procedures to women to be able to harvest these eggs so that effectively that other people could be treated. And it would be a nightmare.
Well, first, I have to leap in and say that one of the, they bring embryonic stem cells, they sort of coax them down certain lineages, and one of the lineages they've been coaxed into recently is into egg cells, so that you can take an embryonic stem cell and coax it toward becoming egg cells. And so, if that pans out and if those are okay, that could be the source that you're saying is missing.
Well, I mean, I guess that could be, but I mean, at this point, that's I guess it's still
all
a very
of all of this is futuristic. A lot of it is futuristic, and I basically think that the embryonic stem cell hasn't been used yet again because it's such a new finding, and they're just working with it in the dish so far. They're trying to figure out how to make it into a heart cell or a tooth cell or a skin cell. And there's terrific research going on to try and figure that out. Again, it's only, 6-year-old so far process.
But we already have with the adult stem cells that have been successfully, turned into heart tissue and successfully treated patients. So, effectively, if we already have success there, why would we, and it works, why would we say that we need to look down another road to get the same result?
I've heard lots of outs about the adult stem cell. The very fact that it's committed already to an organ or a system means that it's probably not going to divide and doesn't divide as well as embryonic stem cell. You want a sort of a fount, a continuous fount for cells, which the embryonic stem cell can do, to churn out all the millions upon millions of mature cells that you're going to need for transplantation purposes. And there just is the feeling, from what I'm hearing, that the adult stem cell can't do that, can't make up those. The out, as has been raised, is that the embryonic stem cell possibly can cause tumors, but a lot of cases they aren't seeing that in the very early trials here or the early research.
I want to thank the caller for his questions, and I need to jump in here because we're getting into our last 15 minutes, and I have a couple of other people I want to get to. One quick question I'd like to ask here, as a sort of a compromise between those people who really advocate full-out embryonic research and those people who say we shouldn't do that at all, some people said, well, you know, we do have this pool of embryos that could be used, and all of these are these embryos that were produced for in vitro fertilization for couples who are having a difficult time conceiving, and that they already exist. And so some people make the argument and said, well, they exist. We might as well use them and put those to some positive use, the ones that are in frozen storage now and theoretically either would stay that way forever or eventually be destroyed. How much would that add to the pool of available material, if we added those to the existing lines that we have?
It's already adding, and there was a report in Fertility Sterility not long ago, well, I guess a year ago, that said there were about nearly 500,000 left over in vitro fertilization embryos just in this country in freezers. Now, what's happening, for instance, at Harvard University? Harvard is teamed up with an in vitro fertilization clinic on the outskirts of Boston, Boston IVF it's called, and they are taking the leftover embryos that couples are saying, okay, it's okay to use these towards research, and they're turning those into cell lines. Harvard reported 17 new stem cell lines. Again, this is through private money, so this is how they can do it. They reported 17 new lines about half a year ago, and they're making more, I believe, as we speak.
All right, let's get some other callers here. Urbana, both of them are Urbana, first line number one. Hello.
Hello. We tend to have a rather provincial outlook in this country, so I'm wondering what's going on in other countries such as Britain and France and the other industrialized countries.
Oh, I'm really glad you brought that up because we are provincial and it's good to look abroad. It's interesting, Hong Kong and England are countries that search through their souls very early on whether to use leftover embryos that were made in a dish or whether to use those for stem cell research and to harvest their stem cells. And they came to the conclusion in both countries that the embryos that are especially under day 14, which day 14 is kind of an important date for an embryo because it begins getting its very, very first bit of neurology and starts dividing into different layers. But an embryo as young as day 5 was not seen to be a person. And because those leftovers were just going to languish there, why not use them? So there's in those countries, for instance, it's a go ahead. And largely in the countries that are Catholic, have predominantly Catholic, there's been a holding back about using them. But just recently, France, which is a predominantly Catholic country, said, okay, we're going to go ahead and use those leftover embryos, and they are going ahead. I believe that the law starts up next August 2005.
All right, thank you.
All right, let's go to line two. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I'm a researcher at University of Illinois, and although I'm not involved with stem cell research or anything like that, but I would like to point out two things in the debate of funding and how to fund research. That I think was a little bit misrepresented in previous callers' comments. I want to point out that if we say that stem cells, embryonic stem cells, were only discovered or isolated in 1998, this is not very long in terms of research. In fact, it's barely a second over a century if we can talk in terms of images, I would claim that we really don't know now the potential of these cell lines, and having this debate right now in terms of potential is really much too early to have an informed debate on that, and we really need the basic research. The second thing is the question of private money. Well, private money is driven by a bottom line. If the private institutions cannot make money out of research, well, they're not going to do the research. This is why our society needs to do the public research. The best example for that is malaria. Malaria has a potential, and we've had the potential for several years to save millions of lives, but all these lives are in very poor countries. We don't have the drugs right now to save these people because they would not be able to pay for these drugs and cures. So again, this research needs to be done in the public domain, so that we can drive and discover the potentials of these cell lines.
I'm glad you said all those things.
All right. Well, I thank the call very much. And if anybody else wants to call here real quick, we could certainly get in one caller at least, possibly two. Our guest, by the way, Ann Parsons. She's a science journalist and has authored a book on stem cell research. It's titled The Proteus Effect. It's out in the bookstore now if you want to read it. I'm just curious to go back to pick up a point about whether, for purposes of acceptance, it really makes a big difference where the stem cells come from. I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that if you're going to take something and put it into somebody's body, the best thing is that you get it from them to start, and then the next best thing is to get it from someone who is genetically just as close to them as you possibly can get. Is that the issue of essentially rejection, particularly in an important issue with the stem cell, and does that indeed add more weight to the idea that maybe it would be we wouldn't have that problem if what we were using was adult stem cells that we got from the person who is going to be the subject of the treatment.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't work all the time. They not necessarily can use their own cells because their own cells might be diseased. But rejection is a huge point here, and it's the reason for something called therapeutic cloning, which is the idea of, it's kind of an amazing thing, that, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners have read about it. And it's just taking, for instance, a skin cell from the patient, taking the nucleus of the skin cell out, and basically causing an embryo to grow up it's taking the nucleus out and putting it into an egg cell. The egg cell creates the climate for the nucleus to start growing like an embryo. So back up, you're taking one cell and growing an embryo up from that one cell from that patient. And so it gives the patient all their own cells to use for therapy.
Yeah. Well, and I guess as an earlier caller mentioned, this does feed us back into the debate about cloning. Even though this is a different kind of cloning, there is what is referred to as reproductive cloning, in which the idea is to get an entire individual. And then there is therapeutic cloning, which is what you've just described here, is to get a small bit use that in a kind of a therapy.
Yeah, stem cell groups are trying to get rid of the word cloning when it comes to therapeutic cloning because it gives the wrong idea that we're growing somebody up to be a full human being when we aren't. It's basically they would only grow the embryo up to day 5 or 6 only, just to get those stem cells inside it. That would be a genetic match for the patient.
One more caller at least, Effingham, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Could you briefly discuss where we stand with stem cell research and spinal cord injury? And I'll listen off the line. Thank you.
All right. That's something a lot of people are thinking about just because of the passing of Christopher Reeve here in the last couple of days.
You know, there's so many people who are going to, be mourning him and missing all he had to say because he was such an inspiration for regeneration medicine, certainly. The spinal cord injury is very complex. It's much more complex than just breaking a bone. What happens, you aren't just breaking nerves, but you're all, maiming one type of neuron, but you're also ruining a different type of cell that helps myelinate the nerves. So there are many different things that need to be patched up, so to speak. There are all sorts of different things that researchers, stem cell researchers, are looking into. They're headed in many different directions. Some are trying to transplant neurons straight into the injury. Others are trying to transplant the remyelinating cells. And it's actually been shown that mouse embryonic cells in the dish can be coaxed into becoming motor neurons, which, and when transplanted, these cells, when transplanted into the spinal cord, they actually survive and can send out axons towards muscle. But we're still very long ways off. I think the exciting thing is that there's a possibility for the first time ever that this could work someday.
Well, I think about at this point we're going to have to finish because we've come to the end of the time. I want to, again, say for people who are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book that we've mentioned a couple times. It's titled The Proteus Effect, Stem Cells and Their Promise for Medicine, by our guest Ann Parson. It's published by the Joseph Henry Press. She's a science journalist. She's written for Boston Globe, New York Times, Harvard Health Letter, other publications, and the book is out now in the bookstore. Also, you might be interested in her book that she co-authored, Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease, that was published in 2000. And Ms. Parson, thanks very much for talking with us.
This has been such a thoughtful discussion. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archive. It was originally broadcast October 13th. Many programs are there, past interviews from Focus, Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production. It's at WILL.UIUC.edu. We're sorry that we could not bring you the interview that we had scheduled, the conversation with Sister Helen Prejean about her book, The Death of Innocence. She's traveling around the country talking, and she was at a hotel in Boston, and they were doing some work on their phone system, and we weren't able to get through. However, we hope that we can reschedule the program, and we'll bring you that conversation, give you the chance to talk with her on another day. Programs here on AM 580 made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design gemstone round tables and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Focus also made possible by grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. So that's it for us. Up next, though, is the Afternoon Magazine host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with a sleep expert. Dr. Mayer Krieger will be our guest. He's an MD who's been